Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. Our panel are here under starters orders, but let's have a look at the front pages first. So obviously a lot of presidential election stories. The Sunday Independent is leading with the presidential candidate Heather Humphreys has issued a stinging attack on Catherine Connolly, and Humphreys is pointing to Connolly's past work as a barrister. The Sunday Times is leading with that Fine Gael are in damage limitation mode and, quotes, hoping for a miracle in the final week of the campaign, according to senior party figures. The Business Post is gone in a different direction. Out of control, in red, critics slam use of judicial reviews as Dart North hit by it now. So there's another project hit by judicial reviews. You could be forgiven for thinking we thought we were going to sorting this out in the 1,000 page planning bill there a couple of years ago, but now it seems that there is a more determination than ever among politicians to deal with this. And I think bear in mind the common good with things like judicial reviews. The Mail on Sunday has, in their words, tracked down Ursula Nionon, who was the convicted criminal who was hired to work in Leinster House by Catherine Connolly. And the Mirror is leading with boy 17 charged with Vadim murder. Ukrainian youth was stabbed to death at Dublin care unit. Right. Our panel this morning, Lisa Chambers is Director of Public Affairs at Concello and former Fianna Fáil TD and Senator. Oisín Coughlan is a Public Policy Advisor. Jennifer Bray is Political Editor with the Sunday Times. And Donico Bacon is Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU. Good morning, everyone.
Morning, Brendan.
So, Jennifer, will you first take us through where things are at, what kind of week the candidates have had, and do all that in a fair and balanced manner?
Sure, yeah. I think it's fair to call it a week of polls and pivots. So the week started with both Catherine Connolly and Heather Humphreys camp finding reasons to be optimistic after a Business Post Red Sea poll that put Catherine Connolly 36%, Heather Humphreys at 25%, and Jim Gavin gone from the campaign, but of course still on the ballot paper, at 12%. Now, some of the field work on that was done before Gavin stepped away from the campaign, but there was this feeling in the Fine Gael camp at the start of the week that these votes could go by and large to Heather Humphreys and even that competition out. So off they both went, canvassing around Kildare, Clare, Limerick, Kerry, Cork, all across the country, while notching up more media appearances on yet more debates. And I don't know if you found this about the debates, but it's kind of like this Russian doll nightmare where you think you've woken up for a nightmare, but it's actually just another nightmare when you're going through all the debates, because all the questions are the same and they keep coming up the same again. And that's kind of how the week panned out. So a couple of things cropped up issues wise for the candidates on the This Week debate. Heather Humphreys took what I felt was a bit more of a confrontational approach with Catherine Connolly. She challenged her on a couple of different topics. Catherine Connolly was questioned on her views about the EU after she confirmed she voted no in the Nice referendums and Lisbon referendums, Nice being primarily about enlargement, Lisbon being about the powers of the European Parliament and about MEPs. For Heather Humphreys, the issues which came up for her, she found herself saying sorry to hear basically that Lucia O'Farrell, the mother of Shane O'Farrell, who was killed in a hit and run incident in Monaghan, she felt terribly disappointed. She said that Heather Humphreys didn't support the family's campaign for a public inquiry into failings in the criminal justice system surrounding her son's death. Obviously, Lucy O'Farrell has long campaigned for answers about why the driver was out that night. And Heather Humphreys kind of explained, you know, I was a minister, I was very, very busy, and she was very sorry that the family felt that way. So that was something that cropped up at the start of the week. Another issue which came up again was Catherine Connolly's employment of a woman who served nearly 4.5 years of a 6-year sentence for possession of arms and ammunition. This is the Airigi member, Ursula Shannon, who Catherine Connolly hired in 2018 as an admin support role when she was working in Leinster House.
We need to move on through the week a little bit now.
Sure,
so are we still near the start of the week now? We need to start moving towards the end.
I was hoping you'd chivvy me along. I have so much information in my brain from this week. I'm only delighted to have an opportunity to put it. So kind of power on up until until the middle of the week, you have both campaigns canvassing around the country. And then this poll landed Wednesday night, Thursday morning from the Irish Times, Ipsos BNA poll. Landed with a crash, I will say that. So this put Catherine Connolly 38%, Heather Humphreys a good deal back 20%, and Jim Gavin, like I mentioned, still in the ballot paper, 5%. Now, the really interesting part of this poll, I thought, was those who said they won't vote, 12%. 6% said they'd spoil their vote, which I think is something you might want to get into later. And 18%, which is a fairly sizable chunk, saying they didn't know. And if you stripped all of those out, theoretically it's possible on that poll to see Catherine Connolly hitting 60% and possibly getting over the line very early doors. But yeah, do you want me to give the health warning?
Based on one poll. Well, I'll give the health warning.
Yeah.
Polls can be all over the place, in particularly in presidential elections. And we've seen a lot of examples in recent elections, haven't we, both here and abroad, where the polls got it completely wrong.
100%. Now, what I will say is all of the polls seem to be saying the same thing that Catherine Connolly said. But we have 5 days to go if you include today. Also, you know, Catherine Connolly has a lot of support amongst younger voters. Will they get out and vote? And will all of these polls actually galvanise the Heather Humphreys camp in the next couple of days?
In your own piece today, you're saying the phrase you use is the campaign took a vicious turn this week.
I just felt that the tone from the Fine Gael camp changed. I felt they became more confrontational. If you listen back to the This Week debate from this day last week, actually, for the first 20 to 23 minutes, it was actually Heather Humphreys challenging Catherine Connolly on everything from her position on the EU to Brexit to Claire Daly and Mick Wells, you name it, it all came up. And Catherine Connolly was put in a position where she was kind of answering.
Now, yeah, I know. Look, let's be fair. Equally, Heather Humphreys has been put under pressure. You mentioned the issue of Lucia O'Farrell and all that. So, like, they're both being put under pressure.
Yeah.
You do make the point that you have Aidan Regan, the politics professor, in your piece. He's saying this is cordial compared to a lot of countries.
Do you know when I...
Because we talk in this country about how vicious these campaigns are.
I know. It was so funny because when I was writing the piece, I kind of had... I'm taking soundings a lot from politicians, you know, who have all their own views about how the campaign is going. And then Aidan comes in very level-headed and says, actually, our European counterparts would look at these debates and say they're very timid. And they're not that, you know, he doesn't view them as overly aggressive, but does think that it's become more confrontational. But what happened after the poll came out in the middle of the week? On Thursday, I rang around kind of contacts of mine, sources in Fine Gael, who I would trust to kind of give me a proper overview. And the thing that came across the most was that they were baffled, was one word that was used. And they felt that no matter what comes up in the campaign with Catherine Connolly, that nothing sticks, was the phrase, that she's Teflon. And Catherine Connolly would argue, well, I have answered every question that's been put to me, regardless of whether you like the answer or not. I have actually answered them.
Yeah.
And there was this real feeling of desolation and deflation, and even one person said devastation that night in Fine Gael, because they thought, we're chipping along, we've changed our tack, we're getting a bit more confrontational, we're getting into this now, but this might actually be backfiring on us. And that kind of leads us then into this weekend. I can get into a little bit of what happened yesterday, if you like, and today.
Okay, briefly, in a balanced way, what happened yesterday? I want to bring in the rest of them as well.
Sure, yeah, both candidates were out.
By the way, we should just say that the Irish Times poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 2.8%, and it was 1,200 voters surveyed, and they were surveyed from Sunday to Tuesday.
Exactly, okay. And also face-to-face in their homes.
Okay.
So this began to Catherine Connolly's campaigning in Limerick and Clare. There was an interaction with Enoch Burke, which I don't propose to overly get into. Catherine Connolly was also accused in local media of kind of dodging media. She didn't do any appearances yesterday, which normally she would make a virtue of doing them. There could be a whole range of reasons for that.
Yeah, I think she was quite busy moving on, and everything was the reason she was giving as well. Yeah.
And I was told that she was absolutely mobbed by journalists who were out there, who I talked to afterwards, and they said she was completely mobbed when she was out canvassing. The other thing as well is Heather Humphreys was in Blanchardstown and Swords. She appeared alongside Sean Gallagher, basically appeared from the inside of a shop. I was told yesterday morning, be on alert because we have a big endorsement coming out. And I said, is it a celebrity? And this person said, yes. And then when I heard it was Sean Gallagher, I'm just going to say I was quite surprised. He's obviously a former presidential hopeful. But what was interesting about what he said when he backed her, he actually said, I'm calling on Fianna Fáil and Fianna Fáil leadership and Micheál Martin to kind of come out and back her. And what I'm hearing from Fine Gael is they're not very happy with Fianna Fáil. They don't think that Fianna Fáil are giving them enough support, fulsome support.
Okay, I think that's a fair roundup of everything so far. And then, Oisín, out of nowhere, in the Sunday Independent, Daniel O'Donnell comes in and speaks a lot of sense, I think a lot of people will feel, about the general tenor of the race and people not feeling that they have much of a choice.
Well, he says, I think, two things that are relevant. One is that he wouldn't run for the president because of how brutal the campaign is. I mean, that's something we've spoken about in this studio before. The job might be a sinecure in some ways. The campaign is the most brutal in Irish politics. And we've proved that again.
And he makes this interesting point that when someone Googles the president of Ireland, no, I'm sure the waterfall of news will overtake this. But if you Google the new president of Ireland in a few weeks, the stuff you're going to get is a lot of the kind of negative stories.
Yeah, it's a 7-year term. That will fade. And the other thing, he does reflect something that's in that Irish Times poll too, that people would have liked more candidates. I mean, it's hard to know to what degree that is about democratic choice and what degree that's about entertainment. But certainly there is a sense that there is.
We can have both.
You can. Yeah. But there isn't enough choice. And I think there will be a debate over the course of the next 7 years as to whether or not the system for nominating candidates needs to be reformed, albeit that it has stood the test of time in many ways. And the obvious reform is to, like in the Dáil, where it's 20, Dáil and Shannon, 20 members of the Oireachtas, it should be 100 councillors or whatever the equivalent percentage is, rather than councillors in each one.
And that they would all be, they'd be from a certain number of areas.
Yes, because he says it's unfair that the bigger parties told their councillors not to nominate people. I don't know about that. I think, you know, you're not obliged as a political party to facilitate your opponents to put forward their best campaign.
Lisa, do you think Fianna Fáil were accused, and Gareth Sheridan mentioned it again here last week when he was on the panel, of doing a soft whip on this, and basically, you know, they did aid and abet Fine Gael in locking out candidates. Do you feel that might have been a mistake?
I'll say a couple of things on that. So Fianna Fáil didn't issue a directive to their councillors to block anybody or to not vote for somebody.
Yeah, I said a soft whip.
Yeah, but yeah. Councillors are very experienced politicians, many of them serving longer than Oireachtas members. And they're fully aware that if you're a Fianna Fáil councillor and you've got a Fianna Fáil candidate, you're going to back that candidate and probably not do something that you think might make their chances of getting being successful, you know, reduce those chances. So Fine Gael probably, arguably, maybe shouldn't have bothered to instruct their councillors because they would have done that anyways.
Okay.
They wouldn't have voted for another.
And
can I also make a point as well, Brendan?
Has it worked out well for them? Do you think people are annoyed with them over it?
I do. But it's worth pointing out as well that one of the reasons we also have such a limited field is that the left coalesced around one candidate, which is quite unusual. So Sinn Féin haven't run any candidates. They've just backed another left candidate.
Yeah.
Sock Dems, Labour, they didn't run their own candidate either. So I would suggest maybe people...
Yeah, and also... let's not let Fianna Fáil off the hook. One of the reasons we only have two active candidates is because... Fianna Fáil did not appear to vet their candidate very well.
Yeah, look, it wasn't a good experience, and we are still dealing with the fallout from that. But
I'll come
overall,
back to the fallout in a minute.
Yeah,
I want to ask you about that.
I don't think the political establishment, be they government or opposition, set out to have a two-candidate race.
They might not set out to have a two-candidate race, but did the political establishment kind of sew this one up and keep independents out?
Well, look, what has transpired is what De Valera's constitution originally intended. I mean, that constitution, when enacted in 1937, was a Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael world, and it always intended to have two candidates. And from 1938 to 1990, there were never more than two candidates. Sometimes there were no candidates. There was an uncontested re-election, or Douglas Hyde was by acclaim. But only in 1990...
When you had two behemoths of parties,
yeah,
but the world has changed, hasn't it?
You know, for many reasons, we say the 1930s constitution may not be made for a more complicated 21st century society. And there are many ways that you could kind of reform that. I mean, in many countries I've lived in, for example, you wouldn't give it to political parties to devise who the candidates would be. You'd say you have to collect a certain amount of signatures, which are verified by the Central Election Commission, and that would indicate that there's a certain amount of popular support for that candidate, which should be then tested at an election. That's one way of taking it away.
Yeah, I suppose we're supposed to have a version of that system here with the county councillors, but it didn't really work.
No, because again, as De Valera intended, that would be dominated by political parties.
Dornicka, if you keep demonstrating this kind of arcane knowledge of the constitution, you will be suggested as a presidential candidate the next time out.
But I think it's worth pointing out that we described the behemoth back in the 50s and 60s, but there's far more variety of councillors and TDs now. There's 230 members of the Oireachtas. You only need 20 to get nominated. That's not a very high bar. On the council side, I think if Maria Steen had done what Gareth Sheridan had done, which is put in the legwork over the summer, she may well have got those four councils. Mm-hmm. So I mean, judging by the kind of people who put themselves forward to the councils, most of them weren't serious and didn't do the legwork. Gareth Sheridan did, but was unknown beforehand, and it was a bit of a leap for people. So I think under the current constitution, there were routes for other candidates, but just they didn't manage to get a critical mass of support.
Yeah, no, again, Gareth Sheridan recalls, and it's mentioned again today in the papers, walking out of one of those things, and a Fianna Fáil saying, we put a stop to his gallop now after he could have got his final council. So, Dunica, I'll come back to you then, Lisa.
Sure, I just wanted to highlight the debate about the spoiled vote, because it takes up a lot of space in the papers, if I may. So, for example, The Independent have two columnists, John Burns and David Quinn, great title, Spoiler Alert, and John Burns is arguing for essentially a spoiled vote. He's saying, spoiling my vote is not an empty gesture, it's the only way to express my anger about the limited choice which we've just spoken about. And David Quinn is arguing more for strategic voting, the lesser of two evils from whatever perspective you have. And then The Indo has an editorial on it where it concludes by saying that, look, you only get to vote every 7 years, you shouldn't waste your vote by spoiling it. And what's interesting about that, again, if you take a comparative, look at the world, what many countries do is that they institutionalize what would otherwise be a spoiled vote. So many countries have, for example, either a against all candidates option, or regions have.
Right.
Yeah. So Kazakhstan, where I lived for a while, had it in the 90s, for example. Nevada has it. Ontario and other Canadian provinces have it. And that allows people to...
You think it's a legitimate form of expression?
It institutionalizes.
We have it this time.
You see, I thought you would say that you have lived and are familiar with countries where people have fought so hard for democracy and to have democratic choice.
But this is an expression of democracy. If you are genuinely unhappy with what's on offer, you have a democratic right to express that. At the moment, it can only be done by what we call spoiling the vote. But in those regions and countries, what people were doing was institutionalizing that. And indeed, in Colombia, since 2014, if actually a majority of people tick that box, they have to constitutionally call a new election.
Well, we effectively have a none of the above option this time, because if one of those candidates wins and resigns, then we have to have another election.
Lisa, it's not a critical mass of Fianna Fáil TDs have said, variations on, if I see the name Fianna Fáil opposite a candidate, I'm voting for that candidate and that's it. Do you think there's a chance that there's any kind of critical mass there among disaffected Fianna Fáil voters to effectively spoil their vote by voting for Jim Gavin?
Well, I'll say it's not a spoiled vote. It's a valid vote if you vote for a candidate that's duly nominated and still on the paper.
But who has absented himself from the campaign and basically said, I don't want to be the president.
Yeah, look, he has down tools, but it is a valid vote. It's not a spoiled vote because that is its own thing.
What are you getting in your Fianna Fáil circles? Do you think a lot of them are going to vote for Jim Gavin?
I wouldn't say a lot. I think some people are threatening it because they were quite angry as to what happened and just disappointed and a little bit embarrassed, really, with the way things played out. When it comes to the day and into the polling booth and people make the effort to actually get out and vote, I would question whether they may have a change of heart in that moment. But I do think there will be a cohort that will vote for Jim Gavin, number one, and give their number two to either Heather or Connolly. I don't know. And they may do that in protest.
And they may feel that their vote will still have an effect because, like Jennifer, we could conceivably end up in a situation where Jim Gavin's elimination and his second preferences decide the presidency, couldn't we?
Yeah, it's really strange, actually. The vibe I get from people in Fianna Fáil is that this is almost the acceptable way of voting for Fine Gael. Both give Jim Gavin your number one and it's okay, give Fine Gael your number two, and it's kind of secretly by the back channels going to Fine Gael. The only thing I would say is, if it is true that Catherine Connolly is this far ahead, what will matter are those first preference votes, rather than Jim Gavin being eliminated. So I actually think...
It is democratically legitimate in all ways, both to vote for Jim Gavin and transfer to either other candidate.
Yeah.
And it'll be democratically legitimate if one of the candidates wins based on Jim Gavin's transfers. There'll be no constitutional crisis in that case, just for clarity.
There is a feeling that people are unhappy with how Jim was treated, how it was handled. And it's seen as a vote of support to say we don't like the way that was done.
People in the grassroots,
just didn't like the way it was handled. They felt that.
Oh, what's their issue?
Just the fact that he was brought into this campaign, obviously very high profile, and arguably you could say his reputation has been severely damaged, and it's been a very traumatic experience.
Was it
for
not
a person?
People might argue as well it was by his own hand that he was either
you could always argue that
misremembered or economical with the truth and left them in a terrible bind after they had pinned their rosette on him.
You know, it kind of brings us back to the Daniel O'Donnell article. It's kind of saying, is this the price to pay? We've all done silly things in the past, or things that we wouldn't want aired in public. I mean, there's nobody perfect, right? But do we want somebody completely ruined because they've put themselves forward for election? I don't want to see that happen to anybody. And I think it speaks to what Daniel O'Donnell was saying. I wouldn't run for the Oris, nor would I walk. I mean, he was said because of the abuse. I do think there's a feeling among the electorate going, God, who's going to put themselves forward next time?
And listen, I know this is like almost a stock question, and I don't want to ask it just because you're a female who was in politics. But like at any level of politics, is the abuse getting to the point where, let's take it away from Jim Gavin.
We'll
right?
just make it more
is
general.
Is the general kind of price you pay, is it starting to outweigh people's desire to be a public rep?
In short, I think yes, for a lot of people.
Is your life much easier since you got out of politics?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I would say, somebody said to me recently, you know, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. Mm. Now, I have to say, can I just caveat that by saying I loved being in politics, and I'm so grateful for that I had that opportunity, and it was an amazing experience. So there's that, there'll always be that element of it. But we can't obviously ignore the fact that social media and the way that things have moved and the aggressive nature of some commentary is putting a lot of people off. And I do wonder, for all elections, I would love to see people, not just people in their 20s who maybe haven't done a whole lot in life yet, but people in their 40s, 50s, 60s coming into politics after having done something else and bringing that experience. But I think if you've been very successful
going back to Jim Gavin, it wasn't a little thing, and you probably need to be open and own the things you've done and be prepared to stand by them.
Just to say, Brendan, another reason why some Fianna Fáilers are saying to vote for Jim Gavin is that they'll get they potentially, if they get 12.5% for Jim Gavin, they get their expenses back. There's an article there by Daniel Murray on the front page.
Yeah,
of the
turn
Post.
Into your mic there.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and he's saying that Fianna Fáiler have spent €250,000, and you know, if they get 12.5% for Jim Gavin, they'll get that back.
Yeah, I've heard figures are much higher than that.
They spent more than that, or that's what they'll get back.
€250,000 is the potential rebate for any candidate. But
have you heard a figure of 750, which I feel can't be true, but people are saying it, like,
because so.
Given it was such a short candidate.
The 4 to 500,000, I would say it's probably closer.
I was told by two senior people in Fianna Fáil that it was looking like at least €500,000, but that they were trying to recoup the cost by cancelling a lot of the things that have been planned.
But your biggest spend is your posters.
Yeah, absolutely.
So once the posters go up, I mean, that's your biggest expenditure.
And putting them up and taking them down.
So it is
the big thing, really.
It's front-loaded, yeah. Okay, Lisa, can I ask you about, there's a piece in the Mail on Sunday, and it's by John Drennan, John Lee and Valerie Hanley. I know it's panic stations for FF and FG. I just want to ask you about the Fianna Fáil side of this. So the narrative was, over the last week or two, that Micheál Martin had done a mea culpa act of contrition at the PP party meeting, and that for now he was out of danger. People were talking here last week about all he needs to do is get to July, and once the European presidency kicks in, he's good to go then for another while. This piece today is suggesting that there are actually manoeuvres. Tell me first what the piece is saying, and tell me your view on it.
This piece in the Daily Mail by John Drennan, John Lee and Valerie Hanley talks of panic in the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party. The recent poll showing a drop in party support to 17%, 1 point behind Fine Gael, but a good few points, I think 5 or 6 behind Sinn Féin.
No, 10.
Sorry, 10.
That poll suggests 10 behind Sinn Féin.
Yeah.
Fianna Fáil were down 5.
Up 5. As well, the drop in Micheál Martin's own personal rating of 11%.
Which he is generally in polls is always the highest. Popular leader.
Usually. And talking about, well, one TD being quoted as saying that Micheál Martin is a shell of a person. I mean, I think that's maybe a little bit dramatic, but anyways, everyone's entitled to their view. And that members of the party, those supporting Jim O'Callaghan, for example, are studying the party rules, the CORU, to see how the election process might unfold. And some remarking then on the weighting giving to the membership, which is 45%, to TDs, 40%, and then to senators, MEPs and councillors, 15%. So it's actually weighted slightly more in favour of the membership in terms of choosing the next leader.
And that there's a bigger grassroots down the country in most commons as well. So people like Norma Foley, for example, would have would have a lot more followers, say, in a situation
like this. Yeah, so we, Fianna Fáil, have a one member, one vote policy. You pay your membership annually. So some constituencies would have far more members than other constituencies. So my own constituency of Mayo would have quite a high membership. You could pick a Dublin constituency, it would be much lower. And that's just been the trend. I think that's the same for actually a lot of political parties. The rural areas tend to have higher paid up membership. So that's, I mean, that's in the mix.
Now, so could Jim O'Callaghan, if it is he, could he be bounced in, even if people felt Jim O'Callaghan thought the time wasn't right and he'll bide his time, could he be bounced into something by a rural grassroots revolution here?
I would say that people that join a political party and pay membership are very politically tuned in terms of how the party works and politics in general, current affairs. You know, they're not the average punter, right? And I think that they will look, they would be very clever in their voting. This is a very informed small electorate. And they will look at who is best placed to take on a leadership role, to lead the party into a successful election. So all of these things come into play. It's not just the localised element, although that plays a role. I will also say, I think that this is maybe a little bit overstated in this particular article, is my own view on this.
Yeah, okay.
Micheál Martin has been written off on how many occasions I've lost count.
Yeah.
And he is still there and he is still...
No, Jennifer, there's no doubt that that poll did seem to kind of give people in Fianna Fáil the collie wobbles, even if they had settled again after the PP Party Act of Contrition, did it?
Oh, 100%. And I think someone said to me during the week that the party is still hurting. I think what they were really unhappy about was that the combined support for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael for the coalition is at kind of a historic low. I think it's around 35%. And the other thing I would say about the Fianna Fáil kind of manoeuvrings and the rumblings, Fianna Fáil had the opportunity, if they wanted to unseat or begin to unseat Micheál Martin at that parliamentary party meeting. I think they had this opportunity that they've, some of them have talked about behind closed doors for years.
Okay.
And instead of kind of using it as an opportunity, if that's what they really wanted, when they came, I was actually outside the room when they came out at 12:30 that night. I hung around to try and get some colour for a piece. And actually what they were more saying was, God, that was very emotional.
They'd had their catharsis. It was done.
It was cathartic. Yeah. I didn't get the impression they were like,
quickly
yeah.
before we go to a break.
It's interesting that Leap at least is about membership, and it could be that the rural members of Fianna Fáil are decisive when the election comes for who the next leader will be, but they don't have the power to oust the current leader as far as I know. That's the parliamentary party. And so far, you know, that usual rule about he or she who wields the knife doesn't wear the crown. I don't know whether any of them will have the gumption. Thank you.
Briefly, Lisa.
That parliamentary party meeting and the way it was handled was really important, because I think that the appearance of the 6-1 news
we know
was,
that. Okay.
So that is important. I don't see any movement in the interim.
Grand. Okay, Lisa Chambers, Oisín Coughlin, Jennifer Bray and Donal Bacon staying with us. We'll take a break. Welcome back. Our excellent panel still with us. Lisa Chambers, Oisín Coughlin, Jennifer Bray and Donal Bacon. Oisín, a huge talking point this week was the swimmer Shane Ryan, who has decided to take a part in these so-called enhanced games. And there's a piece with him in the Sunday Times today with Ian Begley. Most I made as an Olympian was €18,000.
Yes, so it's a good interview with Shane Ryan, explaining why, you know, having given 10 years of his life in his 20s basically to swimming for Ireland and never making more than €18,000 a year, he's made the choice to earn, I think he hopes, between $200,000 and $600,000 by participating in the enhanced games, and that is games where you can take performance enhancing drugs. And it is it shows how much our athletes give of themselves to represent Ireland, and how the supports are there to some degree from Sport Ireland. I wonder, is the fact he had to come to live in Ireland because he'd been living in America and maybe didn't have the same support structure here, also I think shows how arbitrary it is who makes money from it, because he didn't get, seems like, the sponsorship deals that other Irish athletes get. So basically, if you don't get the sponsorship deals, you don't earn anything beyond a basic living.
Funnily enough, even if you do, I've just read David Gillick has a new book, right, telling his story, and he's on the show next week. It's an absolutely terrific book, and he doesn't spare himself at all in it. He would be viewed as somebody who had a really successful career. But my view on Shane Ryan and thinking fair play to him for only a few quid was really informed having just read Gillick's book, because you see what they put into it, what they give up, and what they get in return, sure. like really, and what they do for all of us, like so when you think about it.
I agree, and we saw this summer how much sport can give the nation and give us all the uplift and the encouragement it gives young people to participate. But I do think this story with Shane Ryan is both sad in the way we've just described and scary, because as they get to the end of this article, they talk about he's going to be flown to Dubai this winter for them to basically experiment on what drugs work best for him. And this is funded, and there's an article about Mark O'Connell.
He says he'll be under like a lot of medical supervision.
Mark O'Connell has an article in the Weekend Irish Times, if we're allowed to mention a weekend paper.
And
it's about how this is being funded by Peter Thiel, and a lot of it is tied into that Silicon Valley transhumanist ambition. You know, they want to leave the planet and go to Mars. They want to move beyond the limitations of ordinary humans, and indeed move beyond democracy a lot of the time. And these athletes like Shane Ryan, they're being exploited in a way by those who want to experiment and see what the body can
or
do.
Or he's exploiting himself. No, well, he's not transhumanism. It sounds like it's human growth hormone, testosterone, and I think there's something else in there as well. I've seen him make the point during the week. He has a shoulder issue. He wants to get that right again. A lot of these drugs seem to be mainly about aiding in your recovery. I'm not diminishing it in any way, like, but I don't think they're exactly like putting bionic chips in his brain or anything, are they?
No, and I mean, I don't know, I'm not as outraged about this issue as lots of people seem to be. He's a grown man, he can make his own decisions. I don't think he's been exploited. I think he's making his decision with all of the knowledge and information to hand. So if he wants to do that, that's his choice. I think there's issues more broadly around, I mean, he's 31 now, so he's kind of arguably at the end of his professional swimming career for Olympics. So maybe that's part of the decision, that he's happy to walk away from that because that's the choice.
Oh yeah,
right?
I think that's what he says. He says, I've done my bit.
He's done his bit.
And now this is a new chapter, and he's saying essentially it's showbiz, they're putting on a show.
It's entertainment. It's not the same as the Olympics or real, as well, obviously it's real sport on a level playing field. It's entertainment.
I suppose the argument is, Lisa, and you're from very much from a sporting background, the argument made by people like the Taoiseach and others is that this is a bad example for young people and unsporting, like they participate for the joy of it and for the pride in themselves and the winning and all that kind
but
of thing.
But I just think, don't compare it to the Olympic Games. It's not. It's completely different. It's entertainment. The only thing I would caveat that by saying is that you could have young boys looking on, thinking, I want to do that, or I want to look like that, and maybe seeking to do that without the supervision and doing it in a very unsafe way. Yeah. That's the dangerous element of it. But I don't think we should all, you know,
you can imagine,
pile in on top of Shane Ryan. As because he's this kind of like lightning point for this broader issue. Clearly he hasn't been properly supported as an athlete over the years. €18,000 a year.
Well, I think he got the support that's there. Like, in fairness, that seems to be what there is there. Maybe the question here is like, why are these people who, like, I know from being in this studio, and I know we know from the atmosphere in the country when these people are doing well, how much they give, and again the price they pay. Jennifer, Luke O'Neill has, let's take a bit of science on this.
Yes.
Luke O'Neill has a piece about this in the Sunday Indo on the actual science of this.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This is the other side of it. So he's pointing out that the drugs allowed at the enhanced games, and you mentioned them, he says they include anabolic steroids such as testosterone, growth hormone, and I'm going to mispronounce this, I'm sorry, erythropoietin. And he kind of goes through what they are. But later on in the piece, he points out that all of these come with potential side effects. He says testosterone can damage the heart and liver and cause infertility. If someone takes too much erythropoietin, there are so many red blood cells that, coined the term, turns blood to jam. In that case, people can experience huge pressure on their organs. And the point he's making is these are not drugs to be taken lightly or without proper supervision, which you pointed out there is.
We know that there are guys in gyms all over the country taking, I think, T-gel, they call it, and stuff under no supervision whatsoever. Yeah. So maybe if you're going to do it, maybe Shane Ryan's doing it in the right
Brendan,
place.
I remember as a teenager staying up late at night or getting up early to watch Ben Johnson run down the track in Seoul in 9.89 seconds and the exhilaration of seeing that happen. And then we discovered 2 days later that he'd been on anabolic steroids. And the shattering of that illusion, of that dream of, and I know the Olympics is...
But there's no illusion here.
Yeah,
there's no illusion here.
But you can imagine...
Like a lot of athletes would say, like, the frustration they've had of staying clean all these years when they know that loads of people around them are doing this.
There's been a lot more attention paid to getting sport as clean as it's possible to get it over the last decade or two.
And we know it's not clean, don't we, Lisa?
This is just, I would just separate this out. This is not normal sport.
Yeah.
It's entertainment. People know it is. It's very open and upfront. I wouldn't do it, right? I'm sure lots of us wouldn't do it. But at the same time, it speaks to a broader issue around athletes, their earning potential. You could even look at GA people as well that have come through, you know, in this unprofessional, basically professional sport, what they give into it. And what happens when you get to your 30s and everything moves on and you're left then having given up your 20s. So I think it's a broader conversation. Let's not all rain down on top of Shane Ryan.
It won't stay in its lane. You can imagine what the toxic manosphere online will make of this next year.
Donegha, let's go back to bigger matters. So Ukraine very much back in the frame in the last few days. The piece you picked was Barry O'Halloran in the Sunday Independent. But just I'd be interested in your general take. You're a keen watcher of this situation and an expert. Where do you think things are at now?
Well, look, a lot of it hinges on Donald Trump, unfortunately, as it does for many other conflicts in the world, which he's allegedly solved, of course. And the trouble is that he wants to disengage whatever US involvement there was there. It's clear, you know, that who's at fault here. I mean, Russia invaded Ukraine, but also Ukraine has signed up to a ceasefire. I mean, Donald Trump had a very simple plan, just stop fighting. And Ukraine immediately said, OK, we sign up to a ceasefire. Russia has escalated the conflict. At every point, there's been 8 conversations now between Donald Trump, both in person and on the phone, since he became president. And every time Donald Trump comes away full of optimism, upbeat, we're on the verge of a great historic agreement, and I'm responsible, I'm the deal maker. And every time more missiles and more drones are fired at Ukraine.
Now, this goes against the conventional wisdom, I know, at this weekend, but I'm sure you read, did you read that piece in the FT about what happened at Alaska, what really happened, and the suggestion that Trump went in to sit with Putin and Putin started giving one of his long historical lectures and Trump said, screw this, I'm out of here, lunch cancelled, I'm going, and that that actually kind of changed Trump's positioning on the whole thing.
Yeah, and you did notice.
Is there any hope in that?
Well, there is no hope in it, because what happened then is that there was no conversation until the other day with Putin, and you did see a noticeable change of emphasis, is what I would call it. I mean, he was calling Zelensky, and of course he invited Zelensky to Washington DC, and Zelensky came full of hope, having, you know, there was talk of Tomahawks, which would be a very big change to Ukraine's arsenal, being given by the US. Of course, it wouldn't be given in terms of charity. I mean, the Europeans would be allowed to buy it and hand it over to Ukraine. And then, you know, and this is what Barry O'Halloran is saying in his piece, essentially all Putin had to do was pick up the phone. And that completely decimated Zelensky's plans.
So you
and
think that torpedoed, so
absolutely,
to speak, all
just
of that?
Even look at the optics.
What about this argument that people are making that the reason Putin picked up the phone was the threat of the
missile?
Well,
that's it. No. And from Trump's, if there is method to Trump's more transparent madness, I think what he's trying to do is the carrot and stick. And the carrot is, and he said in his Truth Social post afterwards, that they spent a great deal of time talking about the trade, the wonderful trade that could be kind of done between the US and Russia after the war is concluded. That's the carrot. And the stick, of course, is hinting that he might enhance the supply of weapons to Ukraine. But can I just stress the optics here? When you looked at Putin coming to the United States in Alaska, there was the red carpet with the Red Army. There was the flyover by the F-16s. There was the Trump on the tarmac clapping for Putin. And there was the drive and the beast, the two of them together. We'll never know what was said there. When Zelensky arrived this last week, there was no one to meet him at the airport. He had
the head of protocol, I think, that woman was there.
He had actually to organise some of his own staff to be there to greet him. And it was.
Did you feel as well? I know people say, oh, you know, the famous White House meeting where you know, there was very bad blood. Did you feel the atmosphere at the one the other day as well wasn't entirely friendly towards
Zelensky? Oh, God, it wasn't.
Zelensky.
And again,
sure wasn't. People are portraying it as that it was a fairly neutral meeting. It wasn't, like, surrounded behind him with kind of MAGA-ish press barking questions at him from behind his back and kind of trying to catch him out with, like, who's a better negotiator? Biden or Trump and stuff. It was still quite an arena, wasn't it?
And again, you compared that with Putin. Had told Trump he wouldn't take questions from journalists, and no questions were asked. It was just a brief statement, and off they were. As you say, I mean, it was very disrespectful the way that Zelensky was treated. And these aren't real journalists. These are just hangers-on of Donald Trump who are allowed in the room, and they ask all sorts of, you know, questions that are really unbecoming for a person of Zelensky's stature, and indeed all that he's gone through and his people have gone through, to be treated in such a way. Never is that kind of disrespect afforded to Putin.
Okay, yeah. Oisin?
I mean, the answer to one of those questions is that Trump does appear to be a better negotiator than Biden, at least, because he did, at least for a period of a week or 2 weeks, put more pressure on Netanyahu than Biden ever chose to do. And I do think there is a chance here that he's entertaining the tomahawks, which again Biden never did, in order to make Putin come to the table. So, like, we don't know what's said inside the beast. We don't know, like, it is possible. The only person I think that does have the leverage to make Putin do some sort of deal is Trump. And we won't know until after they meet in Budapest or wherever they do meet, whether or not Trump has the attention and the conviction to actually force something through, and whether it's fair or not. We don't know either.
Lisa, would you be slightly more hopeful than you've been in the past?
It's really hard to know, isn't it? I mean, I think Trump is motivated by the Nobel Peace Prize. So he's looking at that thinking, right, I've solved the Middle East, whether he has or hasn't. I'm moving on to the next one now.
Yeah. So we could have a good year out of him, like, if you know, the Nobel Peace Prize is a year off again.
If he manages, with all of the people have different views on him, right? If he manages to get the Ukraine war to stop, we'll all be quite thankful for that, I'm sure. I think he treats Putin differently to Zelensky because there's a different power dynamic. Yeah. He views Zelensky as having not bringing an awful lot to the table in terms
of... Zelensky needs something from
Zelensky
him.
Needs
Russia,
something.
Russia needs nothing from anyone, does it?
Trump is part of the issue. Trump responds to strength, and they're quite... There's a lot of similarities in terms of what both individual leaders seem to respect, right? They like strength, they like a show of power. And I think Trump views Putin very differently to Zelensky. Look, he has more respect for his position and his authority, and he sees Zelensky as having very little of that.
But you kind of feel there is some admiration from Trump as to how the Ukrainians have fought over the last few months. Like, he is very sort of based on his most recent stimulus. So I think he has some admiration for how strong...
Before we leave this, Donika, do you have a theory that the Chinese holding off on rare earths and those minerals might be inclining... Or is it, Oisin, you have that theory, might be inclining Trump?
If China, and I think they were doing that just for their own, they're adopting Trump's strategy for trade negotiations, but if that makes Ukrainian rare earth minerals more important for the US economy, then perhaps it strengthens Trump's interest in actually getting to a ceasefire in Ukraine.
And also it would mean getting territory back, wouldn't it? Because a lot of the rare earths are in territory that is currently occupied. Okay, and then Gaza. Jennifer, you picked a piece by Matthew Campbell in the Sunday Times, and such a simple thing, fresh fruit on sale again, but fear still stalks the streets of peace deal Gaza.
It's just a really evocative piece about people in Gaza kind of seeing for the first time food on sale that they haven't seen in a very long time, these colours and textures of food like strawberries and other vegetables, and going off to cook them and kind of being able to eat together for the first time properly.
When you say it like that, we have seen Gaza in black and white for so long. The images we see there are all black and white or grey.
Yeah.
And the idea of a strawberry there.
Exactly. Yeah. And the joy that brings. And, you know, all of this food is like massively overpriced, obviously, huge inflationary. But it just paints a really kind of really vivid picture of that piece. And also another part of it that I was really struck by was this idea that how tentative this ceasefire is. You know, there's still this ongoing kind of back and forth about releasing the hostages. I think Turkey are trying to get in to help basically locate some of those bodies from underneath the rubble, and this fear about undetonated devices still being in there. And a lot of still tension, I think, about whether that part of the deal is actually being enacted. And then there's obviously the question of Hamas trying to reassert its authority over people in Gaza at the moment.
Donika, what do you think about Hamas on the streets? In a way, like, who else is going to be there for now? But is that going to be difficult to dislodge and replace with some kind of international force or whatever?
Of course it is. And it's similar again to how Trump has been dealing with Ukraine. I mean, there's this kind of almost theatrical performative, we have peace, but there's no process. There's no real kind of framework. I mean, there was an article in The Independent, I don't have it to hand, which was talking about the experience of Northern Ireland, and Keir Starmer was saying that, you know, about the IRA decommissioning, and this could be a model for Hamas. And you just compare the processes. I mean, the Good Friday Agreement had all stakeholders involved in reaching an agreement, and there was something for everybody. I mean, nationalists were given a framework by which they could achieve their ultimate political objectives. Unionists got the status quo in the short term, all of that. What is it really, apart from like that the Palestinians are promised in the short term, and I think there's no guarantee for the medium term or the long term, that they're not going to have their families obliterated by bombs, happening every night. What is there in terms of a Palestinian state, self-determination? What's going to happen to the West Bank? It's very Gaza-focused. None of that is there. All the detail is left afterwards. And it's not going to be Trump that's going to be picking up the pieces.
And I think a lot of people seem to be saying that Israel's statement of intent in keeping Marwan Barghouti in prison, when they have released other people who have done dreadful things, is a statement that we do not want. He is viewed as somebody who could be a reasonable leader for a two-state solution, but they're not letting him out.
Yeah, so, and we should just listen to what the ministers are saying in Netanyahu's cabinet. They are openly saying, we have no interest in a Palestinian state. We are essentially for a one-state solution, a greater Israel, and their actions belie that as well. They're annexing more
and
more territory.
No, he has. Netanyahu has gone against them now so far in even accepting this deal, I suppose.
I think it may unfortunately be like that first ceasefire, whereby the first stage was the Israelis got something, in this case they got the hostages that were alive, and the second one was all the difficult points that the Israelis might have to give up
something. So as long as Hamas are dripping out bodies now, two more last night, that things hold for as long as that happens.
But even then, Oisin, briefly, they haven't opened the Rafah crossing. So in the article in the Independent, they're saying that there's only 338 trucks have got through and been distributed, when it was supposed to be 600 trucks a day in the 10 days since the ceasefire started.
This is Sam Mednick and Sammy Magdi.
They're still constricting, like they're still using aid and food as a weapon of war.
And people will argue that Hamas could be in good faith finding those bodies, but that Hamas are still using
the
bit of leverage.
Given what we know of the destruction of Gaza, it's going to take some time to find the bodies. But also, you could see why they would want, it's the only leverage they have left, and we've no guarantee Israel won't go straight back in afterwards.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break. Lisa Chambers, Oisin Coughlan, Jennifer Bray and Donegal Bacon staying with us. Welcome back, our panel still with us. Lisa Chambers, Oisin Coughlan, Jennifer Bray and Donegal Bacon. Lisa, will you explain to us the front page of the Sunday Business Post? Eoin O'Hare has a story, out of control, critics slam use of judicial reviews as Dart North hit now.
Yeah, so Sean O'Driscoll is here saying he's the head of the ESRI, that the use of judicial reviews is out of control and paralysing infrastructure delivery.
So we've known this for quite a while, have we not?
We have, Brendan, yeah. But there's been a complaint lodged, or a JR lodged against the Dart North project. We also have Metro North coming through, just got planning that could potentially hit roadblocks.
But the Minister for Transport, announcing the Metro North recently, said, so we've got the planning now, it's all going, let's hope we don't get any objections. But let's hope we don't get objections, like was the policy.
But behind the scenes, and this is every infrastructure project or even a housing development, it's nearly assumed that you'll get one, at least. There's always one, is what's been said. So we really need to get to grips with this, because judicial review is being weaponised. It is being used to frustrate projects, really, where there's no genuine basis, I believe, in some of these cases, for doing so. So there are some proposals. Now, Jim O'Callaghan, this was covered, I think, maybe a month or two ago in the Business Post. Yeah. So the Civil Reform Bill is being brought through. Now, you mentioned the planning bill that went through last term. I was there when that went through. It took us 4 years to get that bill through, and it's still not enough to deal with this. There were elements that were removed, or it was kind of adjusted. It was still a fantastic piece of legislation and it was needed, but more is needed on this specific issue of judicial reviews.
So did you not know at that point that judicial reviews were a problem? They were, and why wasn't it dealt with in that piece of legislation?
There were differing, I'll say is that there were differing views among the coalition partners as to how, there was three parties in government at the time.
Yeah, and the Greens.
Well, look at it.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay, we'll ask Oisin in a minute about judicial reviews.
The judicial review process, what they want to do is end spurious challenges to developments, rebalance the rights of individuals versus the common good, and putting more weight towards the common good of projects, have a speedier, fairer and used only to challenge genuine issues posed by new developments, and sharper focus really on the public interest. And where there is a procedural error, that has to be material. It cannot just be used to kind of upskittle.
Okay, so
a
people were finding basically at small glitches like that.
These are massive projects.
And environmental
and you're back to square one then. Years added on to a project and cost added on.
Oisin, do you think there's
one other important point, Brendan? there'll be a new threshold to get leave to apply for judicial review, that you must have substantial grounds as opposed to just an arguable case, that there must also be a reasonable prospect of success and a substantial interest in the project. So this really is going to make it much more challenging for people to challenge projects where they really... It looks like there's no impact on them or people.
Oisin, do you think a lot of judicial reviews are spurious? And basically, there is a kind of a general portrayal of a lot of people taking judicial reviews as being a nuisance to the common good.
Yeah, and I think there are some myths and shortcuts in that narrative that are worth challenging. But I am, like, I believe in infrastructure. We have to build railways and wind and solar around the country. And
we have a self-inflicted thing built into our system that is stopping and delaying so many
very good.
But projects.
I don't think it's very clear, both in housing and in infrastructure, that the JRs, the judicial reviews, are not the only issue by any means. And it's worth pointing out just some of the issues that come up. For example, in this case, in Dart North, it's a developer that's taking the case, the judicial review, not a disgruntled local or an environmental NGO.
Yeah, okay.
And a lot of even in the case of the housing ones, a lot of the JRs are taken by developers. Whereas if you listen to the Taoiseach, you'd think it's some lonely environmentalist or some NGO. And that's often not the case.
Yeah, I don't think the Taoiseach specifically said that, but there can be a general.
He suggests that we shouldn't take JRs based on climate action. So basically, if the government is failing under the climate law, he wouldn't want to.
I don't think
to court.
He exactly said well, that. But Jennifer, there seems to be a big energy now and annoyance in the system around judicial reviews.
And actually, this all comes on the back of another review that has been taken against the new apartment guidelines. And there was a meeting of ministers the week before last, a cabinet committee meeting, and they were told that this review could potentially stall the building of all new apartments in the state.
But don't forget, when
that review's been taken by politicians.
When a JR is won, and I agree that it's a procedural issue, they should be allowed to modify that and go back and correct it. But often it's because...
Cancers.
The government or the local authority has done bad planning in the first place. If our planning was better, the NGOs, for example, if it's an environmental issue, who take cases, wouldn't win them. And the likes of Antashka rarely take cases that they lose. So some of it is we just don't do planning.
Lisa,
well.
you're making solidarity there.
Just, because we know we've got a major problem with judicial reviews being used not in the way they were intended and being overused and being used to block projects solely for the purpose of delaying, to make it so costly that people will ultimately walk away. 7% is the annual inflation on a construction project. Every year we delay, that's how much more it's going to cost the state. The public interest has to come first. We are too slow and too cumbersome at delivering infrastructure projects.
A major roadblock.
Donica, are we worse than other countries in your experience? You're the closest to an internationalist here. Are we worse or is it the same everywhere?
No, we are worse. There's no question about that. But some of the best performers are actually the authoritarian states because they don't have to deal with the same kind of processes. I remember living in Tashkent in Uzbekistan for a year and they built their metro after the earthquake of 1966 and they asked me about what was our metro like and I had to explain. That was 20 odd years ago now and I had to explain that even though we were an advanced Western democracy, we didn't have a metro. And I explained, well, how did you build your metro? And they simply said, well, the government decided on it. They brought in hundreds of thousands of volunteers, in inverted commas, to build it. And I said, well, what about people that were in the way? You know, because that's the big issue in Dublin, like, you know, what are you going to do with people who are discommoded? And they said, they just built suburbs, you know, very far, far away apartment blocks, and they moved everyone there.
Yeah.
So
okay.
That's
so
the
look,
other extreme.
So look, yeah, we have a lot of democracy in this country and no
exactly.
harm. Oisin, to finish up today, there are probably a lot of sideline dads and mums out there now as we speak, and maybe some of them have half a headphone in their ear listening to this. So
there's a nice piece in the Sunday Times on page 16 by Matt Rudd on the different type of touchline parents, whether that's dads who've been drinking the night before, or those who think they should be the referee, or those who are coaching not just their own child but all the children there. My favourite bit there's the end though, which is midlife crisis person. Why did I have so many kids? Why do all these kids have to play football? Why are they all the games miles and miles away? Why is it raining again? Why is it Monday tomorrow? And just
half the country. Which one are you?
Well, I find myself as the anxious person. Will my child get on? Will they be subbed? Will they lose the ball? Will they score a goal? Will they be happy?
Okay, you need to translate that into anger. Start shouting at the coach and blaming him. All right, thanks very much to my terrific panel this morning. Lisa Chambers, Oisin Coughlan, Jennifer Bray and Donica O'Bacon. And it's just coming up to 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom now.